So welcome to lecture six. And I'll start with a quick summary of some aspects that we've seen in previous lectures. So remember that what we were trying to do is given a local Hamiltonian, and a local Hamiltonian is a Hamiltonian that can be written as a sum of local terms. In the Ising model, this was terms that affect two spins at a time, nearest neighbor spins. Given a local Hamiltonian, our task was to find the ground state. And we've learned to do this in different ways. The first method that we used was full diagonalization of the Hamiltonian, right? And this was building a matrix which is 2 to the n times 2 to the n for n spins. So that was pretty large matrix. And it had a time, the cost, computational time, was 2 to the 3 n, scaled in n with n in this way. But then we realized, well, we don't really need to diagonalize the Hamiltonian if we just want the ground state, say. And so we could use sparse diagonalization functions in Julia. We use aix instead of aik to request, say, one, or a small number of eigenvalues. If we just want the ground state, we just request one. And this was based on the basic idea there was the power method. You start with some state, and you multiply it by the Hamiltonian, and you keep doing that. In this way, you generate an evolution towards the ground state. We talked about the power method, which I just mentioned. And then there was a more sophisticated version of that, Lanczos method, which is really what's happening when you call aix, the function aix. And so there were two possibilities there. We could either build explicitly the Hamiltonian again. And then in this case, the time was scaling as 2 to the 2n. Or we could even not build h, but use the fact that h, the Hamiltonian, is a sum of local terms to have this sparse vector update, okay, without ever building the big matrix. And then the time drop to 2 to the n with a prefactor n there. Okay? So we've seen all this. And then I was saying that if, in this case, roughly speaking, we with our laptops, we can comfortably get to 10 spins. And with a similar time, here we can now we could get to say 15 spins, and here on the order of 20 spins, okay, and I think I just did this incorrectly. That would be 30, roughly speaking. And then if you use a vector computer and a couple more tricks, maybe you can push it to 40 spins. Okay. Very good. So today, what we want to do is we want to stop worrying about how to get the ground state. We have explained how to do that. And we want to start looking at the structure of this ground state. So far, it's just a large vector, 2 to the n components, 2 to the n complex numbers. But we want to make sense of it. We want to understand its properties. And for that, we're going to look at two things. So that's today. Today, we want to learn about ground states, and we will be looking at entanglement. And we will also be looking at correlations. Okay, and I'll define what I mean by this. And then I need to start somewhere, and we'll start by talking about the reduced density matrix. And some of the things I'll explain, you have already seen in quantum mechanics. It's basic quantum mechanics stuff, but I still have to go through it. So let's start with an n-level system. We have an n-level quantum system, then what we're saying is that the states of this system belong to some vector space, which is Cn. We can have an orthonormal basis. In this vector space, one, I label it like this. And here, orthonormal basis means color product is delta. And then what I can do as a result is that any state I can express in terms of linear combination with coefficient A alpha of these guys, of these elements. Okay? So standard, I'm just introducing the notation here. And now I want to consider the case of, I want to consider next a case where we have two systems. So I'm going to call this a bipartite system. In this case, the states belong to the Hilbert space, which is the tensor product of the vector space for the first one, for the first system, in B, and the other C, B, A and B. And so this, I could denote it like that. It's the state of this bipartite system, this tensor product of two Hilbert spaces. And then, as you know, I can build a basis for the whole Hilbert space. I'm going to assume that this is Cm, and this is Cn. And so I can take a basis for the first Hilbert space, and I just take a basis for the second one. And then I can build a new basis for the whole Hilbert space, which is, I'm going to denote alpha beta. And that is nothing but alpha for the first one and beta for the second one. Okay? Standard, still. And explicitly, I'm just going to do it once to make sure that we're on the same. To avoid problems later on, I could build all the elements in this basis. That's what I mean by this product. And so we would have the 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, n, 2, 1, 2, 2, 2, n, and then all the way to m1, m2, m, n, right? So clearly we have m times n elements, or basis vectors. Very good. And then, nothing surprising so far. So let's keep it like that. I'm just going to say that I can obviously take these basis elements, and I can expand the state as a linear combination of these basis. Okay. And I'm going to be using some diagrammatical notation at some point, where M is going to be a circle with two legs corresponding to indices alpha and beta. Question?
Yeah, so I had a little question about what we did yesterday. So I was wondering, are you claiming that given a sparse matrix, you can actually write code that diagonalizes the entire thing in a time proportional to the square of its?
No, I didn't say that. I said that there is some function, there is some diagonalization technique known as sparse diagonalization, or at least there is a function that does sparse diagonalization that we use, where we could just request a finite number of eigenstates. So I'm not saying that. So the algorithm that we could use, that worked, but in some particular case it worked. So the function AX that we use, right? We use function AX. S stands for sparse, but you still can put inside a full matrix,
yeah.
Dense matrix. Okay, and then what this function is doing is just giving you m of the eigenvalues. But it's the function, so you can use this function, which is called sparse eigenvalue or eigensystem, and you can use it with a dense matrix. And so that would be B1 up there.
Okay. Suppose I do that with a sparse matrix, and I ask to get all eigenvectors and eigenvalues. Then
right.
I completely diagonalize my matrix, and I do that at m squared times.
Yeah, but I didn't talk about that. I talked about getting the ground state today, and that refers to getting the ground state.
That's why I'm asking the question.
Right.
You didn't
right.
Answer it yet.
Yeah, because you know I have lots of things I want to talk about, and I need to stay focused. Right, so we can talk after the class if you want. Very good. So, but obviously, if you want to diagonalize a matrix that has exponentially many or 2 to the n eigenvalues, eigenvectors, then you'll need to go to the, you'll recover the full cost of the diagonalization. Very good. So now I want to talk about this reduced density matrix. And so what's this? Well, again, just a definition. You've seen, I'm assuming you've seen this before. You've seen this before, right? Quantum mechanics. So I'm going to take the partial, I'm going to talk about the reduced density matrix for part A as a partial trace over B of this state, which is on AB. Okay? And what that means is that we're going to make a sum over the basis in part B. And that's going to look like something like this, right? Where this is in B, this is AB, this is again B, right? And we need to explain what it means. So we need to explain what it means to take something that is acting only on B and take the scalar product with something that is the tensor product of alpha and beta, which is acting on A and B, or it's a vector in A and B. But what it means is just remember that this is the tensor product of A, of part A and part B, and so this just means this, okay? This is the definition. When you see a partial scalar product like that, just do what you would think that it's saying. It just, this scalar product refers just to the second part, and so this is going to be delta beta prime, okay? Times alpha. And using that, and remembering that our state was written up there, so what we get is sum alpha prime, sum over beta, m alpha beta, m star alpha prime beta of alpha prime. So what I did is I replaced psi with this expression. So here is the m coming from there. And then that's the ket and the bra. I had to take the complex conjugate. I performed the trace. And so beta and beta here are the same. There is a single sum over beta. And then I can just this whole thing I'm going to call rho alpha beta. Okay, so these are the components of the density matrix, where the observation is that these components, alpha prime, are nothing but m as a matrix. Now, we have complex conjugate, and if I change the indices, it's m dagger, okay? The product of m dagger as a matrix, alpha prime, okay? So if you have expressed your wave function, your bipartite state, as a linear combination of in an orthonormal basis for A and B, this gives you a matrix, okay? And what you need to do to get the reduced density matrix is take that matrix and it's adjoint, and then multiply them, and the components of this matrix are the density matrix. So in pictures, this corresponds to, you know, this would be some matrix, and what this is equal to is put the ket, so that's psi star psi, and trace out part B. Okay? That's what we are doing here. Very good. Okay, so I'm assuming that that's clear, that you've seen this before. Okay, are there questions about this at this point? Okay, so then I can start talking about entanglement. So 6.2, entanglement. In bipartite systems. So I'm going to consider, again, a wave function or a state of this bipartite system. which is the tensor product of A and B, which is expressed like that. And now what I'm going to say is that there are many states that you can have when you have two systems A and B. And we're going to make a distinction. We're going to talk about product states. We're going to say that psi AB is a product state if it can be written as state of part A, tensor product state of part B. And we'll say that it's an entangled state if it cannot be written that way. Okay? And so, examples. I'm sure you've seen this 1,000 times, but you know this tensor product that I already called 1-1 before, that would be an example of a product state because explicitly we have a state for part A and a state for part B. Okay. How about this one? Okay. Is that a product state? My first answer would be, I don't know, right? It's not obviously written as a product state, but maybe there's a way of writing it as a product state. Okay. So in principle, you know, we all know this is an entangled state, but why? I don't know. We just know it. Okay. So we want to go beyond, we just know it. We'll do this in a minute, but let me ask you about this one. Is this a product state or is this an entangled state?
It's a product state.
It's a product state? Why is it a product state?
Because the first one is in state 1 and the second one is in state 1 plus 2.
Right. So whenever it's a product state, or at least in some situations, we might be able to see it, and then we can confidently say it's a product state. Okay? It's a state 1 for first part and a linear combination of 1 and 2 for the second one. Very good. So how about this one then? All right. It's also a product. What product is it?
Oh, the combination of 1 and 2. And
OK, very good. So you see that OK. So in some cases, indeed, we can explicitly see that it's a product state. And then if I give you a very similar state, where I just change a sign here, now, is this a product state? How do you know it's not a product state? OK, so we'll need to develop some method, right? It's not obvious per side. Very good. But what we know is the following. What we know is that if psi is a product state, then rho A, you can compute it, which was the trace of this thing. Now I'm going to write it more explicitly, trace over B of phi A phi A, phi B phi B. Okay. Then this trace obviously is acting on this part. Trace of that, and that leaves us with a projector onto a pure state. Okay, so what we see is that if it's a product state, then what we're saying is part A has its own pure state, and so that is reflected in when we compute the reduced density metric for part A. Indeed, it's in a pure state. Okay? The projector onto that state. So what would be nice is to see that we've seen this. It would be nice to see also the opposite. Okay? So I leave it as a question mark for now. We've just seen that if it's a product state, the reduced density matrix is pure. would be nice to see that if it's the reduced density matrix is pure, then necessarily it's a product. And that's how we would go about understanding always. Well, that would be a way of understanding whether a state is a product state. We compute the reduced density matrix. If it's pure, now we know it. The initial state was a product state. OK, so that's what we want to see. And for that, I want to introduce the Schmidt decomposition. So what we have here is some bipartite system, m-dimensional and n-dimensional. So some state, AB. And what I'm going to claim is that any state of a bipartite system, any pure state of a bipartite system, can be written in terms of some k-max terms, some number of terms of this form. Some coefficient, that I'll explain in a second, and then some sequence of terms where now first chi max is the minimum of m and n. Okay, so I want to make it very clear that in the first any bipartite state can also be decomposed as in terms of alpha and beta running from 1 to so alpha from 1 to m and beta from 1 to n of m alpha beta. Okay? But this contains m times n terms. Now I'm going to restrict my attention. The statement is that I can also write the same state always using only either m or n, whichever is the smallest number of terms. Okay? I can take this into this other expression where we have only, say, for simplicity, m is equal to n. Then I'm saying that this decomposition, the standard one in a fixed basis, okay, will take m square terms. This one will only take m terms in this decomposition. And in addition, this p1 can be chosen. This coefficient square root of p are such that this p can be ordered, and they are all non-negative. And they form a probability distribution. So they add to 1. And this is just a statement that the normalization, that this state is normalized to 1. Okay? So p is a probability distribution. And where, in addition, these guys, the states on part A, form an orthonormal basis, or orthonormal set. And the states in part B also form an orthonormal set. So we call this the Schmidt decomposition. We call this the Schmidt coefficients. And we call this the Schmidt vectors for part A and for part B. OK. And then one more thing about this is that So I state that this is always possible, okay? And then I want to relate this to the reduced density matrices. And it follows, if you believe this expression, then when you try to compute the reduced density matrix for part A, you can take the trace on part B using precisely this basis, which is orthonormal. And so what it follows is that rho A can be written in this way, where this is already the eigenvalue decomposition of rho A. So the PIs, P alphas, are actually the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. And similarly, you can just, a direct calculation shows that you can do the same for part B. Okay? Where importantly, these guys are the same. Okay? So another way to put it is that, well, sorry, first, is it, do you see the logic here how we compute row A if we have this expression, right? The way to compute row A is by just taking this and then taking the trace over B, but we're going to take the trace over B as a sum over beta, over alpha in this case, of precisely these guys. Okay, we'll use this basis to take the trace. We can always take the trace in any orthonormal set that we want. We'll use this one. And that will pick up just these guys. And so that's how we end up with this expression. And we can take the trace also in part A and obtain row B, and we'll have that expression. Okay? Another way to put it is that these Schmidt coefficients that appear in the Schmidt decomposition of a bipartite state, are nothing but the square root of the eigenvalues of row A and of row B. Okay? So, did you see this already? You've seen this, very good. So, now, this may sound like fancy names, Schmidt decomposition, Schmidt vectors, reduced density matrices, but I want to give you a very short description in terms of simple linear algebra of what's happening. And so I want to talk about this given a matrix M. I'm going to take for simplicity M to be M times. So I'm going to take N equal to M here, the dimensions being the same. So I'm going to say instead, yeah, I'm going to, it's a matrix M times N, but for simplicity, I take this to be a square matrix. Then there is something called the singular value decomposition. Which is you can write any matrix in terms of, as a product of three matrices where U and V are unitary. So U, U daga equal to U daga U equal to the identity, same for V. And where S is diagonal and it has, in the diagonal it has what we call the singular values. Okay. So this is a, you know, you can, given a Hermitian matrix, you could, or given a matrix, you can look at the eigenvalue decomposition, or you could look at the singular value decomposition. And the singular value decomposition is just expressing this matrix as the product of two unitary matrices and a diagonal matrix in the middle, in with this diagonal matrix having all the entries non-negative, real and non-negative. Okay? All right. So that's a standard linear algebra statement. And now what I want to do is to just point out that if I take M, Let me look at two objects. Let me look at this object, M, M star. So I multiply M times M, M daga. It's a joint. Okay? And I also want to look at M daga M. Okay? And I'll look at it in a second, but when you see this and you look at a couple of blackboards before, you want to think, oh, I'm secretly talking about the reduced density matrix. Okay? If M was the expressing the coefficients in a bipartite basis. Okay? If this M is that one there, then this product corresponds to the reduced density matrix rho A, and this other product corresponds to the reduced density matrix rho B. Okay? That will be a connection that is there, but I just want to make this calculation in a second and see what we get. So M daga, I'm gonna use the singular value decomposition of M. Okay? So it's U as V dagger times U as V dagger dagger. But that's nothing, you know, U as V dagger, and now I have to transpose and adjoin this. So it's V as U dagger, where I've used that S dagger, it's diagonal and with real entry, so that's the same as S. Okay. And now I see that this is V dagger V, so I can remove it because that's a unitary matrix, so I get S square U dagger. And then the observation is that this is a unitary, it conjugate, and a diagonal matrix in the middle, so that's already an eigenvalue decomposition. Of M dagger. Okay? And what we see is that the eigenvalues are SI are the eigenvalues. SI singular values square are the eigenvalues. Okay? So from the singular values of M, we automatically get, by squaring them, the eigenvalues of M dagger. But let's do this one here. Let's take M dagger M and see that something similar happens. So this is U as V dagger. I'm writing the singular value decomposition of M dagger. Then I write U as V dagger for M. Now this is V as U dagger, and then U as V dagger. This is the identity. So there we are again. We have that we have obtained some decomposition for M dagger M, which is nothing but its eigenvalue decomposition. The eigenvalues are again the singular values square. Okay? So that's a way to understand the relation we had between rho A and rho V. They share the eigenvalues, and the eigenvalues are nothing but the square of the singular values of the matrix M. Mary. Do you have any question about this? Okay, so if there are no questions, we're ready to move to characterizing entanglement in a bipartite state. So what we've said so far was that there were two types of bipartite states, the product states and the entangled state. And then, oh, I forgot one little thing. Sorry, we were building up towards being able to make a statement. So, theorem, which you can prove just putting these things together, let psi AB equal to alpha beta M alpha beta alpha beta. Let this be a bipartite state on CM CN. And let P alpha equal to P1, P2, with the restrictions that we've been using, where P1. These are decreasingly ordered, and they are a sum. Their sum is equal to 1, so this is a probability distribution. So let these guys be the eigenvalues of M dagger, or M dagger M. Okay? theorem says then psi is a product state, so psi AB is a product state if and only if P2 is equal to 0. Okay, so that means that P alpha are 1, 0, 0, and so on. Okay? That's the conclusion. If you want to know whether you have a product state, you take the state, bipartite state, you look at these metrics of coefficients, right? You compute m times m dagger. You look at the eigenvalues of this. These are the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. And it's going to be a product state if and only if the reduced density matrix is a pure state, has eigenvalue 1 and the rest are 0. Okay? And this follows from the discussion we had. Another way to say it is an entangled state if and only if, so this is just the same, P2 is larger than 0. So in this case, for instance, example, we could have that P alpha is, as an example, 1/2, 1/2, 0, 0, 0. Okay? That's just redundant, but I say it explicitly. So if we want to know if our bipartite state is entangled, we compute the reduced density matrix, which is the same as computing m, m dagger, m times m dagger. We look at the eigenvalues. If the second largest eigenvalue is non-zero, then that's an entangled state. OK, so we know how to proceed. And then, now that we know how to tell whether bipartite state is entangled or not, we want to characterize a bit more how entangled this state is. Okay? So it turns out that a product state has no entanglement, but an entangled state could be more or less entangled. And we want to characterize that a bit more in detail. So it turns out that this P alpha is P1, P2, P chi max. These numbers are the best, the more complete characterization of entanglement of the state that you can give. Just give me the sequence of non-zero eigenvalues of rho A. And if I want to keep all the information about entanglement, I'm going to have to keep the whole sequence. Okay? That doesn't mean that in practice we want to use some compressed expression, or instead of keeping all these numbers, we may just want to keep one number. And if we want to do that, then we'll talk about entanglement entropy, or you know, we can have measures of entanglement that take the sequence of numbers and output some number, just one number. Okay? That would be a measure of entanglement. But I want to emphasize that there are many different measures of entanglement. They will tell you different things. But if you really want to keep all the information about entanglement, you should keep all these numbers, not just some function of them. And so this is how we could most completely characterize entanglement. Or equivalently, people talk about the entanglement spectrum by just taking the logarithm of these numbers. So these are going to be entanglement. This is going to be the entanglement spectrum. And we'll be hearing about that, and we'll be studying entanglement spectra in some places. And a small comment about this is that the alpha is invariant under local unitaries. Or local unitary transformations. And what does this mean? It means that if we have psi and this psi AB give rise to some set of some probability distribution P alpha, then if we consider another state psi AB prime, which is equal to taking the original one and applying a unitary transformation on A and another on B. Okay? If we go to our entangled state and we rotate a basis on part A and rotate the basis on part B, then, not surprisingly, we'll find the same P alphas or the same entanglement spectrum. And yeah, and so in particular, if I give you the state 0, 0 plus 1, 1, now it's important to normalize them, this will have the P alpha, it's going to be 1 half, and zeros. But if I give you another state, which is, say, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, which can be obtained from this one by rotating, say, the in B, I rotate 0 into 1 and 1 into 0, and I put a conditional minus 1, then I will still obtain exactly the same coefficients, Smith coefficients, or entanglement spectrum. Okay? Very good. So in practice, though, we like numbers, single numbers. We don't want to carry a vector of P1, P2, P3, and so on. And so what we do in practice is we use one single quantity. And so that brings us to the entanglement entropy. Which I assume you have also heard of. And so what we're going to do is we're going to remind ourselves what the von Neumann entropy is. This is of a density matrix. So given a density matrix, the von Neumann entropy is defined as minus the trace of rho log. I'm going to be using log 2 rho. Okay, that's a convention that you can choose, log 2. But this is nothing but in terms of the eigenvalue. So if rho is equal to a unitary and conjugate, and then these are the eigenvalues, then this is nothing but P alpha log 2 P alpha, and this is nothing but the Shannon entropy of this probability distribution, okay? Shannon. So that's a classical entropy measure. This was referred to quantum mechanics. There is a density matrix here, but now we define, or we see that this definition leads to the Shannon entropy of the probability distribution. Very good. And so the entanglement entropy, E, then, so the entanglement entropy of psi AB is defined to be nothing but the entropy, the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix, which happens to be the same for, obviously, for rho A and for rho B, since they have the same spectrum. And we just briefly consider two examples. So examples. So what we have is, for instance, if we have a product state, then we said P alpha was 1, 0, 0, 0. And so if we compute the entropy in this case, the entropy of this probability distribution is minus 1 log 2, 1, minus 0, log 2, 0, etc. And this gives us 0 because this part is 0. And this is minus infinite, but this one wins. So this is also 0. Okay? And so we get 0. So as we wanted, a product state has 0 entanglement entropy. So that's a good sign. We could use this entanglement entropy to decide whether the state is entangled or not. Because it's 0, you can show that it's only 0 for product states. And if we had what we call a maximally entangled state of 2 qubits, and this would be, for instance, this one, then what we have is P alpha is 1/2, 1/2. And so when you compute the entropy, you get minus 1/2 of log of 1/2 minus 1/2, again, log of 1/2. Okay, this is all log 2. And this is nothing but minus log of 1/2. And this is the same as log of 2, which is 1. And we call this EBIT, okay? EBIT, entangled bit. Very good. So this is what you may know from quantum mechanics or from quantum information. And what we want to do in the last 15 minutes is to see how we're going to use this measure to characterize the ground state of our spin chain. Okay. Good. So finally, we can go back to the problem we were interested in. We have been able to compute the ground state of our spin chain. And now we would like to start studying. We want to study its structure. And so we're going to look at the entanglement in many body states, specifically ground states. And I want to tell you that, to me, I work on entanglement measures about 10 years ago. And to me, it's a bit disappointing to see that all we do in practice to characterize entanglement in a many-body state, has many pieces, is just to look at bipartite entanglement, which means we break the system into two parts, A and B, okay, and then we look at how entangled that is. Actually, this is a very, it's a useful characterization already, but this is not even touching the concept of many-body entanglement. It's just bipartite entanglement, okay. So what we say is that we have this spin chain, and we are going to consider the state of the spin chain, which is a state of many copies of a single spin Hilbert space, which I'm assuming it's spin 1/2, so it's C2. Okay, we have n. If we have n spins, we have n copies of C2. Okay, and so in particular, we can write this state in a local, in a product basis. We've been doing this. That would be alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha n. These are the coefficients in this basis. Okay, this is what we've been doing already. And what I want to do is I want to split the chain into two parts, A and B. So for example here, I'm going to assume for concreteness that we have 5 spins. And I'm going to break this, say, into 2 spins and 3 spins. Right? So this is spin number 1, number 2, 3, 4, and 5. And I take defined region A and region B. To be A is the first 2 spins and B the second, the last 3 spins. And so now in this case, what I have, again, more explicitly, is a sum alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, alpha 5 of psi alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, alpha 5 of this thing. Okay? And what I want to do is I want to look at all these coefficients. I'm going to reshape them into a matrix. You've been doing that already. What do I mean by this? I'm going to define a new index mu. I define it to be the product of the index alpha 1 and alpha 2. Okay. Alpha 1 is labeling the stage of the first spin. Alpha 2 is labeling the stage of the second spin. So I define a composite index mu as the product of those two. What this means, again, explicitly, is that let's look at all possible values of these spins, okay, of this index for the first spin and for the second spin. It's 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. Mu is, I could call it 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so mu is going to take four values. I do the same for the other guys. So nu, I'm going to define another index nu, which is the product of alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, and alpha 5. And so explicitly 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, all the way to 1, 1, 1. And that's going to be the value for nu, 1, 2, 3, all the way to 8. Okay? So I'm just grouping these indices. I have five indices, but I can always define composite indices so that I can now equally write this as sum over mu and nu, okay, of some matrix of coefficients m mu nu. And now I have here mu for part A and nu for part B. Okay? I hope that's clear. I'm just reformatting all these 2 to the 5 coefficients into a metric. And I'm just taking this and this states as defining just a bipartite system. This is part A, states part A, part B, and I call them mu A and nu B. Okay? So in other words, what's m mu nu? Well, this is just psi alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, alpha 5. And that is the famous reshape that we used with iJulia, right? You can reshape a tensor with 5 indices into a tensor, a matrix. Very good. So after doing that, what I've done is I've translated the problem of talking about this wave function for 5 spins into, I've translated it into the problem of talking about a bipartite system, a wave function of 2 pieces. And so all I can do, it's left for us to do now is I could compute rho A, the reduced density metric, for part A, which will have coefficients mu, mu prime, and that's going to be m dagger, mu prime, okay? And from here, if I diagonalize these metrics, then I can extract the eigenvalues, and I can, in particular, compute the entropy for the region. So that's what we've been talking about just a moment ago. So what I want to do is I want to do that for this bipartition, but I will also do it for many different bipartitions. So when we study entanglement in many-body wave functions, and we restrict our attention to bipartite measures of entanglement, we don't get a number out of it, but we get an entropy for each bipartition that we use. So we had, continuing with our 5 spin system example, we could take A to be this and B is that. Okay. And then in this case, we'll get some entropy. So in this case, I'm going to call L equal to the size of A, how many spins we have, and that's 1. And then I'm going to label, I'm going to compute the entropy for L equal to 1. Okay. But I can also decide to take another bipartition. So in this case, the size of A, so now this is A and this is B, the size of A is 2 spins. And so I can extract the entropy for 2 spins and so on. So in general, there are even more. Well, let me draw this. So you get the idea. We'll have n minus 1 such bipartitions, where I'm restricting my attention to, you know, the spins in a spin chain are ordered from left to right. So I want to take blocks A will be a region of contiguous spins. Okay, I'm not going to take a spin. A is not going to be, or what we'll use later, A is not going to be this spin and that spin. Okay, I'm not considering that situation. So I'm starting from left to right, and so I'll get, in general, these entropies. So instead of just one entropy, we get a vector of entropies, and we can plot them. Okay? So this is going to be L. In general, this is 1, 2, all the way to n minus 1 for n spins. Here we can plot the entropy of part A as a function of the size L of part A, and we'll get some, you know, some numbers. And we'll see some profile. And that is going to start telling us about the structure of entanglement in this wave function. So specifically, conformal field theory has a prediction. Which we will be testing. And this is work of Calabrese and Cardi. I think it's 2004 or 5, 4. And the prediction is that when we look at this sequence of entropies for the ground state of a CFT or of a critical lattice model, what we get is S L is a profile as a function of L that is doing something like this, okay, where this curve here is given by entropy of L is equal to C over 3 log 2 n over pi sine of L pi over n plus some constant, where this happens to be the central charge. Okay, and again, what we have, therefore, is that we will extract this. This will be numerical data. Okay, but the central charge, so this is numerical. But there is a central charge here, which is telling us about the universality, so it's universal, and this central charge is another property of the CFT. Okay, there were the scaling dimensions that we saw, conformal spins. Central charge is one other universal property of the CFT. Okay, very good. I wanted to tell you about correlations, but I think I can do it this afternoon. So we'll meet today at 2 p.m. and what we'll do is we will see how to compute these entanglement entropies. Now, we will do that both for ground states, the ground state of the Ising model, but also we'll do it for a generic wave function of n spins. Generic meaning random. We'll choose 2 to the n coefficient randomly. We'll also compute the entanglement entropy. And what we'll see is that if this is the behavior of the ground state, so that's CFT, ground state. Okay, this line here. What we'll see is that a generic wave function has another, a very different profile. Okay, we'll see that it's random. State. Instead of following this logarithm with a sign inside, it's just going to be, it will have much more entanglement entropy. Okay, and this will be valid. We'll generate many instances of random states, and we will see it always looks like that, much more entanglement. And so this will be the first hint. We'll see it this afternoon. It's going to be the first hint that ground states are very different from generic states of the Hilbert space, and that is going to be a key insight into understanding how to efficiently simulate ground states and go to very large n. Or you know, nowadays we can deal with infinitely long spin chains, okay? If we just care about the ground state. So this afternoon, we'll see the first hint that there is something going on there. Okay.